far as I know, I think it's a very unusual project because I think it is maybe the first time that a major Western country participate with the Chinese counterparts to investigate the cultural heritage that they looted from China.
It's coming from these German individuals, and it is putting a lot of pressure now across the water, perhaps in the UK, where we have standing as a symbol, really, of colonialism, the British Museum.
I think these organizations should increase their clout. We should increase pressure, incentive, and quite frankly, shame on the part of the countries that continue to hold these artifacts.
The Chat Lounge. Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
It's time to find a way back home. A group of German museums is trying to unravel where their Chinese collections originated, as looters may have taken many of these relics from China's imperial palace over a century ago. Will the German move pave the way for the repatriation of thousands of looted objects? What obstacles must be overcome before we can see the stolen treasures permanently back on their home soil? Welcome to the Chat Lounge. I'm Tuyun, joining our discussion on the way looted Chinese cultural relics returned home are Dr. Huo Zhengxin, a professor of law at China University of Political Science and Law, David Moser, an associate professor at Beijing Capital Normal University, and Mike Baston, a China observer and senior lecturer at the University of Southampton in the UK. Welcome to the chat, gentlemen. So, seven German museums launched provenance research a few years ago. The endeavor aimed to produce guidelines to serve as a basis for investigations by other German and international museums into Boxer Rebellion art looting in the early 20th century. Now the guidelines have reportedly been completed, and according to media reports, the number of participant institutions in the provenance research work increased to 100, generating great interest as far as Australia. So, Dr. Huo, it's your first time on this show. I understand you've been engaged in the legal protection of China's cultural heritage for many years. So, to your knowledge, how unusual is such a project?
Thanks for having me. Well, as far as I know, I think it's a very unusual project because I think it is maybe the first time that a major Western country participate with the Chinese counterparts to investigate the cultural heritage that they looted from China. So I think it's a very unusual project. Of course, I think it's a great project because such a research project is very necessary and important.
Mm. We used to have similar projects, you know, featuring Chinese cultural relics being returned home, but those are different.
Most of the cultural heritage that have been returned to China are smuggled out of China in recent years.
Right.
But it is quite, you know, difficult for the cultural heritage or cultural relics that have been looted, you know, 100 years ago to return to China because of a lot of legal obstacles.
Mm. We'll discuss further about that later on in the show. But David, from your perspective, why did the project come into being in Germany instead of France or Britain, where there are supposedly more looted Chinese cultural relics?
Well, you know, Germany, I think the problem in Europe, which is they have since World War II and World War I also, for that matter, I think they feel an obligation to be a better public citizen of the European Union and of the world in general after the atrocities of the Nazis during World War II. So they not only domestically in their own country, but also in regards to other countries in Europe especially, but also in the world, they're trying to improve their image as a global partner, as a global, someone who plays fair in the global arena. So I think that's part of it. The other part, I guess, is because, you know, the people who looted the armies who looted these things during the Boxer Rebellion, mm-hmm. and the armies that came in to fight the Boxers and protect the foreign inhabitants there, you know, included Great Britain and Germany and France and the United States. So I think that all of these countries should bear the burden and to try to do their best. The problem is with, you know, some of the largest amount of looted goods are in the British Museum and in Britain control. And those are the problem with those, I think, and Dr. Huo would know much more than I do, but it's difficult to trace the source of when exactly where it was smuggled out and its path in the 20th century in Great Britain. We can talk about that later. Mm. But with Germany, I think probably because there weren't quite as many, perhaps, artifacts. And also, I think probably there was not quite as much sending these artifacts into the auction arena. And so it might be a little bit easier for Germany to trace these artifacts and their source or how they were smuggled into Europe. So I don't know. That might be why Germany is being so proactive in this case. Right. But in any case, it's admirable that they are. That's good, a good thing.
Indeed. Mike, I'm not trying to embarrass you, or no offense, but what's your take here?
I agree with that. Certainly that last comment from David, that it's an admirable thing, an admirable project, and I'm fully behind it. I also agree with Dr. Hua that it's rather unusual. Hopefully that's changing, and it's leading to certain momentum and pressure on museums from these countries that looted, there's no other word for it, China and other parts of the world, and their governments. I think specifically this project, I think we need to pay tremendous respect towards, I think it's really these two individuals, and that's Suzanne Nerdl and Barbara Plankensteiner, who Susan Nerdl, who started this project in 1994, in effect, by being listed in the Hamburg Museum, noticing that quite a few artifacts arrived shortly after the Boxer Rebellion, and had obviously very, very strong, understandably strong views on what was going on and what should be done and what sort of reparations should take place, with Susan Nerdl. And then it came to the attention of the new museum director in 2017, that's Barbara Plankensteiner, who in effect commissioned this project and got it going as a major project, which was funded by, in effect, the German government, I suspect. So that's how it started. And I agree, it's not a surprise it's come from Germany. I agree with David, given their World War I, World War II records. I think they're very, very keen to show that they are a good, caring, collegiate nation, which they are. You know, quite surprisingly, most definitely, and have been for many, many years. So I think, you know, it's coming from these German individuals, and it is putting a lot of pressure now across the water, perhaps in the UK, where we have standing as a symbol, really, of colonialism, the British Museum.
Mm. Then why do you think it has attracted the interest of so many institutions? The number has risen to, I think, over 100.
I think it's a number of reasons. I think that first of all, I think quite sort of almost privately, I think most people would agree that there's basically a lot wrong here. A lot went wrong and shouldn't have happened in the first place, and it needs to be put right. And so I think these institutions realize that they can't really avoid this. And at some point in the future, perhaps the near future, they have to address it, perhaps reluctantly. And also feel they fear, quite rightly, that there'll be political will and also very strong public will across these countries to really return these relics to their rightful home. And then some sort of reparation, maybe even some sort of compensation as well. That is inevitable, but is gathering such momentum. I think that's why the interest is there now. Hopefully, this project has garnered sufficient momentum and interest to sweep away a lot of this across these countries, including particularly the UK, where it is more difficult to trace. I mean, I read recently the British Museum has 23,000 cultural relics from China. So I think these institutions are quite rightly concerned that they need to address comprehensively and transparently and not sweep it under the carpet as they have done for 70
years. I'm not sure if there is any museum from Britain taking part in this project, but some observers say...
not at the moment, but right. I think that will and should happen.
Right. Some observers say it may be driven by, you know, the losses suffered by the museums under gloomy economic circumstances. We know last September, 9 pieces of historic Chinese porcelain worth around 1 million euros were stolen from the Museum for East Asian Art Cologne overnight. And the British Museum, obviously, is no stranger to thefts. So maybe after identifying whether the Chinese collections are what were originally from the museums, will decide whether it's worth keeping those objects, and it may help, you know, help them save management costs if the objects are returned to China, or the museums can obtain some supplementary funds by auctioning the objects if they are not looted from China's imperial palaces. So, David, what's your evaluation here?
At the time these objects were looted, China was a very poor country, a very backward country. And the colonialist mentality at the time might be that we could be a better caretakers of these antiques and artifacts than they could. Nowadays, the times have changed, and China is a very powerful country and is a very important geopolitical presence. And it behooves people to keep on the good side of China, because the relationships with the People's Republic of China is important to them. And part of that would be a goodwill gesture of giving back these looted articles, which, you know, of course don't belong to them and should be returned to them, but the impetus to do so is much stronger now because China is stronger now. And there's less of a case to be made that China is unable to take care of these artifacts in the manner that they are, you know, required. So I think that's a dynamic that surely is at work here. It doesn't mean that it's not admirable for these countries to be doing this and taking part in this kind of project, but it also says more, a lot to say about the China's role in the world right now and the diminished role of Europe, these European countries.
Right. Dr. Huo, do you agree with such interpretation, or do you think there are some other motivations behind that?
Well, I think that, you know, since 2017, at the Chinese, I find that at least in Western Europe, more and more countries, they are examined or they are reflecting what they have done during the colonial period in African countries and in other parts of the world. And they are rethinking about the illegal acts that they have done in the past. Mm. So I think that this is a very good trend. You can see that President Macron made a speech in Africa in 2017, and he said that his government would not allow this kind of injustice that happening in history would continue in his country. So I think that there are many very optimistic signals. Mm. So I think that this institution, this museum, they participate in this program partly because of this kind of this trend occurred in European countries in recent years. And also I think that this project is of great significance in terms of academic study, because it is also very important for this museum to make clear when and where these culture treasure has been collected from China. And so it is necessary for this museum to get more specific and accurate information of the collections. It's part of academic pursuit.
You mentioned the French President Emmanuel Macron's initiative, but so far it's targeted at those stolen African objects, right, relics. You know, the German investigators describe their provenance research as an internationally pioneering move that will ultimately make the other members of the 8-nation alliance, which was made up of American, Austro-Hungarian, British, French, German, Italian, Japanese, and Russian troops face questions about the repatriation. Obviously, they also want to influence maybe the French side, the government, to join that this kind of a project. But do you think, Dr. Hua, it will actually generate such an effect as the German researchers expect?
So you mean whether the German investigation will encourage more countries to join the repatriation?
Right, and that's what they hope for.
Of course, I would expect this would happen, but frankly speaking, I'm not very optimistic because, you know, first of all, so far I find that these European countries, for example, the French government, the German government, and they now they focus more on the repatriation of the culture treasures that they looted from African countries.
Mm.
They scarcely, you know, pay attention to the problems or the cultural treasures they looted from Far East, from China. So I think that it's, as I said in the very beginning, that it's quite it's an Euro project for the German museum to pay attention to the cultural treasures looted from China. Of course, it's a very good signals, and I hope that this will, you know, encourage more and more European museum to join the efforts to think about the possibility of return the cultural treasures that the European countries looted from Asia countries, including China.
Mm.
But, you know, the situation is much more complex because different countries, they have different attitudes towards their colonial history.
Indeed. And what about Mike? Are you optimistic or?
I'm generally optimistic. I think this project has really pushed things along, but I do share the sort of slight optimism that we've heard from Dr. Hoare and David to a certain extent. So procurement or provenance research and research into the procurement methods of these historical items, really the evidence lies in the West. So for example, with the British Museum in the UK, it will lie in records there. How do people from China or Chinese researchers do this research accurately, legitimately, and show legally what's rightfully theirs and where it came from? Quite difficult. And if you look at the origins again, this project, it really is down to these, from what I can see, these two or three individuals who have taken on themselves individually with a great sense of purpose and a great sense of sort of moral sort of righteousness to actually publicize this and take it forward. It hasn't come forward from these institutions themselves. In fact, it looks like Suzanne Nodal was actually pushed back from the museum for quite a few years until Barbara Plankenstein took over in 2017 and had been responsible for the repatriation of other, shall we say, stolen goods to other countries in the past. So I think it largely depends on individuals with a sense of purpose, will, and moral sort of correctness to actually instigate this. For example, people working with or connected with the British Museum to actually instigate projects, probably in their own time, self-funded, that then gather momentum. I think that's the way forward for each individual country. Government by themselves, I think, will largely try to ignore this. In fact, there was a recent event or incident where the Greek Prime Minister visit to Britain and the UK Prime Minister, a meeting was postponed. And it was more largely because the Greek Prime Minister wanted to publicise the need to repatriate stolen, I think, compartment of marbles through the British Museum, repatriate those to Athens, and he was snubbed. So I think it's down to individuals in these countries, in these museums, these researchers, to take things forward in the way these two Germans have.
Fair enough. This has been the Chat Lounge. When we come back, we'll check out the legal basis for cultural relics repatriation.
Once upon a time, in a land not so very far away. Stories were told of the brave and the bold.
The whole court fell silent to hear what the great warrior Mulan might ask for.
Of mighty deities and powerful immortals.
Immediately, the shimmering skin started to grow before his eyes.
Of fated love, and love sanctified.
In dawn's golden light, Niu Lang said,
"Marry me."
Of great journeys across fantastical landscapes.
So the cat and the mouse climbed on the dog's back, and the dog swam across the broad river.
In the company of friends and enemies and unimagined beasts.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Of ordinary folk with tantalizing stories to tell. Heroes and heroines all.
It's incredible. How did you do that?
Tales of sad sacrifice and victories snatched from the jaws of defeat. Stories of the wise, the accomplished, and the quick of mind. 5,000 years of amazing Chinese folk tales. You'll find Chinese Folk Tales Season 3 wherever you discover your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to the chat. We're discussing the way looted Chinese cultural relics returned home. But we see the British Museum rejecting Egypt's request to return, you know, the famous Rosetta Stone, and the Greece's request to return this Parthenon sculptures to Athens. Why are you optimistic that it will return objects like the admonitions scroll, which is, you know, the centerpiece of the British Museum? Mike?
Well, that's right. I think there will be increased public will and public pressure, and I think the British Museum and the authorities generally will have to bow to that. So that's why I'm optimistic now. I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight.
Mm.
It won't. But I think with this successful project, very successful project coming out of Germany and this particular German museum, I think we could see a lot of momentum. But I am optimistic, and it's calling for a lot of change. But I think genuinely, the majority of the British people would, at least privately, concede that this really is not at all right. It's very, very wrong. And even if it leads to a British museum which looks very, very different, the right thing to do is to give back what is rightfully owned by others and created by others and shouldn't be on display here. And these recent sort of lapses in security blow a sort of coach and horses through this argument that actually they're safer here, they're protected here, they're not necessarily. And also, is it any of the British Museum's business what the rightful owners do with this? It's not. So I think it's the public pressure and I think we'll gather momentum, and I think we're moving in more and more into an age of transparency, and that's where my optimism comes from. But I think it is complex, and then it could take time.
Right. David, do you think public pressure will work here?
Well, I think certainly the more transparency, as just Mike just used a good word there, the more transparency, the better in these transactions. I would say that another reason for optimism is that, at least in the British situation, there has always been sort of a cloud of doubt over these artifacts because once they were smuggled out of China into Great Britain or elsewhere, they begin to fall into the hands of private owners buying them at auctions.
Right.
So by the time they get donated to a museum, or that they end up in some collection somewhere, it's very hard to prove that the artifact has this spurious origin, because the people, they have legal, handwritten contractual rights, so to speak, from their standpoint, to this article because they bought it legally at an auction. The reason I say I'm a little more optimistic about this is there are new advances in technology that make it easier to trace these artifacts and to prove, in fact, that they came from the Boxer, looting. And one of them is that just recently, in the last decade or more, I think, they have taken the entire history of British newspapers, like the London Times, that go back to the early part of the century, even the late 1800s, and digitized them. And so experts in this field are able to look at the digitized archives of the newspapers and look at auctions and look at articles that were up for bid in auctions, and they can trace the path of these looted artifacts in the auction houses and trace them to their current day locations. And with those, with that kind of proof, instead of going to a museum and seeing some artifact that's just listed China, Qing Dynasty, you know, very vague sort of attribution, they now can, with much more accuracy, pinpoint where these, when and where these articles arrived in Great Britain or elsewhere. And right. this could be the basis for some legal action, or at least the basis for some proof of which articles should be returned to the rightful owner. So I think there are things like that happening now that makes it not only public pressure, but also the academic and expert pressure based upon the new kinds of technology that we have to trace the path of these articles outside of China.
Even if you trace the origin of those objects, what they've done mostly is just to withdraw the objects from the auction. And it doesn't mean, you know, they have to return it to China, right? Especially under the current international legal framework.
That's right. Well, you surely remember back in 2008, around the time of the Beijing Olympics, that there was two bronze statues from the Summer Palace, a rat and a rabbit, I believe, that were part of the 12 zodiac animals that were that part of the Summer Palace in the main building there.
Right.
Went under auction at Christie's auction house.
Mm.
And it was legally purchased by a French millionaire or something like that. I don't remember the guy's name.
Right.
But eventually it was public pressure and maybe his own conscience that, I guess, forced him or motivated him to return the two statues in 2013 or 14. I can't remember. But it was a case where, in fact, I think those two statues were repatriated. And it was mostly just due to transparency and public pressure. I might be wrong about the details of that. Dr. Hua or Mike might know more than I do, but that seems like at least one outstanding example of a very sort of disturbing case back then.
Yeah, one of the very few examples.
Yeah, right.
Right. So, Dr. Hua, what would be the biggest obstacle, you know, hindering the repatriation of those looted objects or relics?
Well, I think that in terms of law, there are a number of legal obstacles,
right,
both in international law and in domestic. Let's just take the example of these bronze animal hair. One is rabbit, one is rat.
Mm.
As my colleague mentioned just now, in the year of 2009, it was, you know, put on auction in Paris, and then Chinese people want these two animal heads returned back to China. And then in the end, there, you know, who sued the auction house and the holders of these two animal heads? That is the question. In the end, it is a organization entitled Association for the Protection of Chinese Culture Relics.
Mm.
It filed these lawsuits before a court in Paris. And then the French court ruled that these organizations does not enjoin the standing to sue because, you know, these animal heads, they are looted from China. It has nothing to do with this European organization.
Mm.
So the first legal issue is maybe who has the standing to sue. Another example is that, as you know, that in recent years, there is a mummified Buddha statue that has been lost from China in the 1990s, and then a Dutch holder exhibited in the Hungarian Museum in Europe, and then the Chinese villagers sued this Dutch holder before a court in Amsterdam.
Mm.
And in the year of 2018, this Dutch court held that the local villagers committee, which was a, you know, recognized plaintiff under Chinese law, but the Dutch court says that it is not known in under Dutch law, and then it rejects the lawsuit. So I think that who has a standing to sue is the first issue that has been addressed. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot more legal obstacles. For example, usually the current holder of the cultural relics will allege that he or she is a good, is a bona fide purchaser. Mm-hmm. He said that I purchased it from the market. I do not know that it comes from China, looted by the Europeans or the French troops. So
that happens a lot.
Yeah, purchase, you know, is also an obstacle. Another obstacle is that, you know, current law, both domestic law and international law, they do not have the effect of retroactivities, which means that they would not apply to the acts happened before their implementation. Mm. So for those cultural heritage lost in history, I think the current law, both at domestic level and international level, are almost helpless.
Mm. So you're saying that we now actually have to rely more on the laws of each country or their domestic laws to solve the problem whether those looted objects can be returned, instead of international, in an international framework. Can you tell us whether there is such an international legal basis for repatriation of looted objects? Obviously, lootings happened a lot, especially during the 18th or 19th or early 20th century, right? It's actually a big international issue.
Mm, yeah. Well, you know, that the prohibition of looting cultural heritage is always a, you know, bad act criticized by, you know, by morality, by, for example, by the Bible or by other, you know, religious books. But from the perspective of positive law, for a very, very long time, international law, you know, did not prohibit such behavior.
Mm.
In fact, if you look back to history of human civilization, you'll find whenever armed conflicts occurs, there are a lot of crimes, including the plunder of cultural treasures from the conquered countries. So only after the end of Second World War, international community, they adopt a number of international conventions to prohibit the looting of cultural heritage during the armed conflicts, and also preventing the illicit traffic in the peaceful time. So currently, basically speaking, there are three most important conventions in this field. The first is the conventions of the protection of cultural property in the armed conflicts, which was adopted in The Hague in the year of 1954.
Mm.
The second convention is called 1970 UNESCO Convention, which tried to prevent the illicit traffic of cultural heritage during the peaceful time.
Mm.
And the third convention is called the 1995 UNIDROIT Convention, which tries to prevent the stealing, the theft, and also the return of those stolen cultural heritage. So basically speaking, there are three international conventions to solve the problems today. However, as I said just now, that these international conventions which were adopted after the end of Second World War, they do not apply to the acts happened before their implementation. So international law is almost useless for the countries like China to repatriate its lost or looted cultural heritage in history.
Mm. Then is it possible for UNESCO member countries to establish or come up with a new law governing this? Is it possible? Or to your knowledge, is it underway or anybody are thinking about this?
Well, in terms of my opinion, I think that I hope it's possible, but it's very difficult.
Right.
As I said just now, one of these three conventions is 1995 UNIDROIT Convention. Frankly speaking, this convention is quite good. It's quite, useful for the countries like China to repatriate its stolen cultural heritage, in modern times. But even today, there are only more than 50 countries that have adopted this convention, because most market countries like US or France, they do not want to ratify or join the convention because of their own interest. So technically, I think that the countries like China and other, you know, source countries may take initiative to draft a new convention, and this convention may have the effect of retroactivity. However, I think that even though these kind of conventions were adopted, I'm afraid that these source market countries would not like to join the convention.
Mm. Right. We've talked a lot about the possibility of returning the looted objects, but going back a little bit to, you know, the necessity of this happening, because if that's not necessary, or there's no necessity of a repatriation, those countries wouldn't have to go through so much trouble to do all these things, such as coming up with new laws or keeping things transparent, like Mike and David both mentioned. So I'm wondering, what do you think? Is it necessary, actually, to repatriate those objects? You know, some people say it doesn't matter where the objects are kept as long as they are displayed to the public. So, David, what's your take here?
Well, I think that's obviously a bogus kind of justification. And I think probably the motivation is, unfortunately, what Professor Hoare just said. The countries in which these artifacts are bought and sold on an open market, of course, people are reticent to sort of break up that sort of established framework for buying and selling these things. Mm. But I go back to what I said earlier. I think in the earlier dark colonial days, not only in China but also in Africa and other places, the justification would have been at the time that these artifacts need the care and caretaking of experts in the field and in countries that have money and resources to make sure that they're protected. And so therefore, in some sense, they felt that they were justified in taking them. As I said before, I mean, this justification is long gone. Egypt is very capable of taking care of the Rosetta Stone. Mm. The artifacts that were stolen during the Boxer Rebellion, China is more than capable of taking care of its own artifacts. You just have to go to the Forbidden City, and or just look at the collection, the incredible collection of the Forbidden City, and see how well they're curated and how very expertly they're taken care of. Mm. So I mean, it's just ridiculous. I think the issue now is just, and I do agree, it's not going to be quick or overnight, but I think these organizations should increase their clout, and we should increase pressure, incentive, and quite frankly, shame on the part of the countries that continue to hold these artifacts. They ought to just return them with no conditions whatsoever, but that's not likely. But China, it seems to me, China is very willing to put in the extra effort of getting these artifacts back, including these sort of maddening, sort of infuriating condition under which sometimes they actually have to pay money in order to get them back and to repatriate it. But they're willing to actually do that. So I think that the momentum is in the right direction, but as everyone has said, it won't be an easy task to get all of these things back in their rightful place.
Mm. But Mike, what about you? You know, if we are in the shoes of the British Museum, if everything is returned, it may also affect, you know, the attraction of the museum, and probably half of its collections would be gone.
Well, that's correct. I couldn't agree with David more than that. That is a argument that is just not an argument to fall back on at all. That has no weight whatsoever. That's the case. I think the key thing I'd like to add here is these are incredibly artistic creations, and
sculptures, in the case of China, paintings, embroidery, but a beautiful, you know, absolutely incredible levels of high artwork. They're also very, very significant, important parts of cultural heritage that tell a very, very important story about, in this case, China, Chinese history, Chinese heritage, life in China, the evolution of Chinese art and then the Chinese way of life. And that is not really told in the British Museum. It can't really be told in the British Museum. That can only be told, explained, amplified, embellished in a Chinese context, in a museum, or in a place, in its rightful place, close to their origins in China. But that really is the really limitation for me. There's a huge moral obligation, which is enough anyway. But when you go to the British Museum, as I do, you find yourself saying, "Well, you know, I need more than just to see this almost in isolation or with a brief paragraph in English explaining where it came from." Mm. That's not enough. You will get much, much more insight. And people around the world will get much, much more insight into Chinese heritage, which is what this is all about, if they are housed and developed and there's a proper curation process in China. So I think that's the telling argument. And I have every confidence in Chinese authorities to take that forward, as David just explained. Most definitely, I have absolute confidence there. So I think it's really for the game's up. For the British Museum, you just cannot hang on to what's not yours and you don't really understand.
You are not concerned that the British Museum may, you know, be emptied at all?
I don't think that's an argument. I think that will come as a huge shock to people, and it will really not sit comfortably with a lot of people, not just British people, people elsewhere, because it's a historical monument in itself, this museum. But if you examine and look closely at what's in there, where it came from, and how it got to be where it is, I think the moral argument is there that really that is not right and that needs to be put right. And as I just said, I think we're all secretly lovers of art and history and heritage, want to see the full picture painted around the origins of these items, these artifacts, and that can only be really told and explained in its sort of fullest form, in its origins, in the original context, by those who really understand that context, and those have to be Chinese scholars. You know, a British art scholar can never understand Chinese art in the same way as a Chinese art scholar. You know, they can get closer and become more knowledgeable, but it's not the same. So I will be concerned, and I'm sure a lot of British people listening to this discussion will be concerned as well. But at the same time, I think you have to say, maybe with a heavy heart for many British people, that really this is the way it should be, and they should be handed back.
The Chat Lounge.
The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
And to Dr. Hua, I understand you just returned from the U.S. where you attended a seminar discussing related issues. Maybe, you know, the Japanese scholars attending the seminar are not on the same page with, you know, Mike or other scholars who would agree that the looted relics should return to their homeland, right?
Yeah, I just come back to China this week. I attend the American Society, the annual conference of the American Society of International Law, where we hold a seminar on the repatriation of Chinese culture looted during the colonial context. And you know, as a Chinese scholar, in recent years, I do some research on the looting of Chinese cultural treasures by the Japanese armies during the anti-Japanese war.
Right.
And I find that it's a pity that so far the Japanese government has not returned the cultural treasure that they looted during their occupation of the Chinese territory. That is a pity because, you know, I think that the anti-Japanese war is a part of Second World War. And after end of Second World War in Europe, you know, the Germans have returned the cultural treasures that looted by the Nazi government from other European countries.
Mm.
Yeah, these are war crimes. However, in Far East, because of the complex international atmosphere and the historical background, the Japanese has never returned the cultural treasures that they looted from China. And, during a seminar, when I talk about this issue, the Japanese scholars, they questioned the legalities of the repatriation of the Chinese cultural heritage during this war, because they believe that, well, that is war happened, many years ago. The law at that time does not prohibit this kind of acts.
Mm.
And they do not want to face the problem, which is very different from the European and American society, because the Japanese, they are more reluctant to confess the crimes that they have done in China during the war. So I think that for Chinese scholars, I believe that this is a matter of great significance, because to ask the Japanese to return the looted cultural treasures during the Second World War, I think that it's a effective way to address the unfortunate past of Japanese invasion, and it's the right of Chinese people.
Mm. Obviously, we're going to see such kind of resistance from some countries. I wouldn't say from all of them, but some countries, some scholars, or some museums. But the repatriation of looted items need synergy, right? Like what you've mentioned, public pressure and measures by the government, so on and so forth. But I'm wondering, on our side, what China can do to facilitate such kind of repatriations. In August last year, after reports revealed some 2,000 artifacts had been stolen from the British Museum, a short video series called Escape from the British Museum was released on Chinese social media platforms to raise awareness of the Chinese artifacts displayed or stored in overseas museums. And the series tells the story of a Chinese jade teapot's journey back to its homeland. So to what extent can such moves help the repatriation process, or can it help the repatriation at all, Dr. Huo?
Well, I think that this kind of, for example, this short video, has attracted the attention of the public. I think this will create more public pressure to the British Museum. But I don't think that this will significantly be helpful for the repatriation process, because the museum, like the British Museum, they have faced a lot of pressures from not only China, but also from, let's say, Greece, from Egypt, from Italy. But as you say just now, if they returned one item, for example, to China, and then they are afraid of domino effect,
right,
and then powerful collection will be gone. So I think that this kind of move is helpful, but will not significantly make the difference. So I think in the long run, as you just asked, I think that countries like China should more, I think country like China should do more to influence the international order in this field, because on the one hand, China is a country that has ancient history, civilization, and it has lots of cultural treasures looted and lost overseas. On the other hand, as now our colleagues to say today, that today China is a powerful country, so it has the ability to do more to influence the repatriation process.
Mm.
So the Chinese scholars, I hope that the Chinese public, the Chinese society, and Chinese government can do more.
Right, but the question is, what can they do? Mike, do you have any good idea there?
I would just like to add, these videos do
galvanize, I think, the public and perhaps younger generations. Remember, in China, we have this Guochao, this national wave trend. So I think we can tap into that and somehow link this to that. I think that will generate discussion, positive discussion on Chinese social media. But I think then it's for the famous, the internationally famous Chinese artists, Chinese scholars, perhaps Chinese fashion designers, my background in particular, that have become internationally successful, particularly by very careful use of traditional Chinese techniques, Chinese arts and crafts. I think for that community to speak up more and promote more publicly, not just presentation of Chinese heritage in a proper context, avoiding cultural appropriation, but also the creation or the reparation of Chinese relics, Chinese artifacts back to China. So I think local or that international Chinese community of artists, entertainers, maybe even film stars, to speak up more publicly, that will put telling pressure on both sides, both governments, both the Chinese and on the European side. But those internationally recognized Chinese artists and related scholars to be more vocal, that's very, very important, and that could lead to real change.
And last but not least, David.
Well, I very much agree with Mike, and I know that there have been Chinese movie stars. And by the way, the Chinese diaspora in all European countries in the United States, there are many very, very wealthy Chinese diaspora or descendants of Chinese that I have heard about that have actually bought up some of these artifacts in order to get them back in the hands of China. That's commendable in one sense, but I think it's not the ultimate way to solve the problem because it simply continues the unfairness of the whole thing. I think just raising awareness, public awareness, as Mike just said, is a great way of doing it. And just the simple humanity and fairness of just imagining that if the Mona Lisa, which is in the Louvre, you know, had been looted by the Nazis and ended up somehow on the walls of the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., don't you think France would be doing everything they could to get it back in the Louvre? I mean, that's just obvious. That would be the most obvious thing in the world. And yet we don't seem, and yet the world has not come woken up to the fact that you have a similar conditions in Greece, Africa, and China. But you know, I think it's just raising public awareness.
Right, and increase our national strength. Right. Obviously, it will be a long road full of hardships and resistance. And we look forward to the day when the treasures looted and smuggled out of China during the century of humiliation can all return. So on that note, we've come to the end of our chat. Many thanks to David Moser, an associate professor at Beijing Capital Normal University, Mike Baston, a China observer and senior lecturer at the University of Southampton, and Dr. Huo Zhengxin, professor of law at China University of Political Science and Law, for sharing your time and insights with us. The show is available on all major podcast platforms. If you have any comments, please email radio@cgtn.com. I'm Tu Yun. Thank you for listening. We'll have more chat at the Chat Lounge next week.
Wondered what's actually going on in Africa through the perspective of an African? How are things really going between China and Africa? What's the narrative of this relationship? Well, get a perspective with China-Africa Talk. Hear from African diplomats, entrepreneurs, academics, Chinese natives, and more. Get on our wavelength every week to find out what's real with China-Africa Talk. Find us on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcast, and more. We'll see you there.
Dunhuang. Situated along the ancient Silk Road, where fine arts and divine beliefs merged with the natural world. It's where the East and West interacted, and where the world's largest Buddhist art gallery still fascinates and amazes people today. A place where stories of life and death, love and hatred, passion and desire, faith and sacrifice have been generated and told for 2,000 years. Buckle up for our new podcast, Why We Love Dunhuang, the one and only podcast that can take you to the fantasy world of Dunhuang and beyond through our audio tour. Listen and subscribe for free on major podcast platforms. Why We Love Dunhuang? You will have your answers.